there, and good evening. Welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626, online. Find us at jimbotalk.net. You can follow me on Twitter at Jimbo Talks. Well, remember that deal that was going to guarantee that Iran wouldn't get nuclear weapons? Does not seem to be going quite the way it was planned. Now hear that Iran will only sign a final nuclear deal if the economic sanctions against it are removed on day one. Quite likely a deal breaker. Bob Costantini reports that when it comes to sanctions, the administration is already saying, not so fast.
This will not help the president make his case to Congress. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, in a speech through an interpreter, calling for immediate sanctions relief.
We will not sign any deal unless, on the very first day of its implementation, all economic sanctions against Iran are lifted all at once.
The administration is selling the framework of a nuclear deal as easing sanctions only after international inspectors confirm Iran is complying with the restrictions a final deal would bring. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, is balking, and its president insists sanctions need to be lifted as soon as a final nuclear agreement is signed. Countering that, U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, who says Tehran must show itself trustworthy.
Such as reducing the stockpile, such as reducing number of centrifuges that will be operating. I would give a rough rule of thumb of perhaps 6 months. Could be a bit shorter, could be a bit longer, and it'll depend upon their ability to execute those moves.
Moniz, a nuclear expert himself, is helping to sell the framework to the many skeptics in Congress. A new NBC News poll on the matter shows 68% of Americans don't trust Iran to live up to any deal, though barely more than half think that country's nuclear ambitions pose a threat to the United States. The same survey has 54% of Americans trusting the president to handle the negotiations, while 42% think Congress knows best when it comes to Iran. Bob Costantini, Washington.
We'll talk about that with a couple of guests in the program tonight, starting off in this first half hour with Stephen Bucci. He's director of the Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy at the Heritage Foundation. They're online at heritage.org, and he's an adjunct professor of leadership at George Mason University in the Washington, D.C. suburb of Fairfax, Virginia. He served for 3 decades as an Army Special Forces officer and top Pentagon official in the private sector. He was a lead consultant to IBM on cybersecurity policy. Stephen, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me back on the show, Jim.
It is, I don't know if I'm surprised or not. To me, I thought this deal shaped up as a pretty good deal for Iran. So the mere fact that they're tossing out what I know they can be kind of delusional at times, but what they surely know is a deal breaker makes me wonder, were they really that concerned about this deal that they felt the need to torpedo it?
Well, I think that their concern from the get-go has been getting the best deal, the most relief, the most time that they can get out of this situation. And they've done that. You know, we eased off on some of the stuff as soon as they came to the table. So they've had the freedom to do that. They've been, you know, twisting us into pretzels. And now a lot of the American people don't know who's telling them the truth. Was the press release that our folks made the right one, or was it what the Iranians are now saying that they actually agreed to? You know, some of it's language confusion, some of it's just different impressions, but boy, it's sure not doing anybody any favors other than Iran.
No. You have to also wonder if Iran maybe finds this administration so weak and so pliable and so desperate for an oak leaf cluster for Barack Obama's Nobel Peace Prize that they might actually go along with this. I'm wondering that also.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I've said it here before. It's a quotation from Jim Mattis, the former CENTCOM commander. You know, he said that the Persians haven't won a battle in 3,000 years, and in the same time period, they haven't lost a negotiation. They're really good at negotiating, and this is a classic negotiation thing. You shake hands, you say, yes, of course we'll do that. And as soon as you walk out in public, you declare something different with the hope that the other side will be sort of shocked and embarrassed into at least giving some of the ground towards your demand. And I think that's probably a pretty good strategy against this administration.
Now then, that is perhaps their strategy and as likely an explanation as I've heard. And yet I look at this administration and I have been highly critical, but I'd have to think that there has to be a limit, even for this administration. Could they possibly now say, oh, okay. I mean, could they actually do that?
You know, Jim, I would hope that the answer would be absolutely not. You know, I know there's plenty of people on the Hill. You know, it looks like there's probably going to be enough Democrat senators to go along with the Republicans to maybe pass a bill that's veto-proof, because I think that the legislators and the citizens of this country are fed up with Iran. But, boy, this administration is so bound and determined that getting a deal is part of their legacy that I'm worried that they could buy this bad a deal.
1-866-50-JIMBO is our number, 1-866-505-4626 on the Bohannon Show. Now, the lifting of these sanctions, to what extent has that hurt the mullahs? I understand it's had some impact on the citizenry, but it's not like the mullahs have to run in the Tehran primary or anything like that. I mean, they are, to a certain extent, insulated from day-to-day Iranian disfavor.
Yeah, they are, but you know, they felt it. You know, they had their own Persian Spring uprising a while back, and unfortunately, our administration didn't do anything to offer them any support at all. So the Iranian people, you know, even after all these years of living under the mullahs, there's a ton of them that don't particularly like this type of government they have. So even the mullahs have to respond sometimes to that public opinion. They don't have to give in to it. They can crush it, but they do have to respond to it. So the sanctions were having an effect and driving them, at least initially, to the table to try and get some sort of relief.
Mm-hmm. Are you satisfied that we, even with a limited number of inspectors, but satellites and all the rest of the high-tech toys, that we could really adequately inspect a country that is the size of the continental United States from the Rocky Mountains westward to the Pacific Ocean? That's a lot bigger than Iraq, which is about the size of Texas, and a lot of territory. And to simply, for example, inspect where they've had facilities before, or inspect where they tell us they have facilities, hardly strikes me as sufficient, even assuming that the deal went through.
No, I'm not comfortable with that. I think, you know, the inspection regime that we had for Iraq didn't work very well. You know, none of these inspection things, I mean, I'm not a big arms control person, because verification, and particularly in oppressive regimes like this, pretty much impossible. If they want to hide something, they can hide it. And they already started that thing when their defense minister said early today or late yesterday that, hey, our military facilities are not part of this. That's totally off limits, and nobody's going to inspect those things. So they're already backpedaling from the inspection agreement part. I'm not comfortable at all that the AEIA is going to be able to keep track of their program.
Stay with us, more to come as we talk about what now appears to be Iran backing off from even the fairly generous deal that they had been offered. And we're talking with Stephen Bucci, director of the Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy at the Heritage Foundation, online at heritage.org. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show. As we look at Iran now balking at the deal that they signed, at least that's what everybody has reported, The deal that, of course, was deemed too weak even by France. That's France, exclamation point. But it could very well be that the so-called more moderate president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, may be trying for even more out of this deal. And, of course, there was an identical declaration by the real power in Iran, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He's the ultimate religious and political authority in that kind of bizarre mix of church and state that they have, or mosque and state. Stephen Bucci, our guest, is with the Heritage Foundation and spent 3 decades as an Army Special Forces officer. At this stage of the game, you talked about the possible passage of a veto-proof bill in Congress to do what? To declare that, in fact, this is a treaty and that, therefore, the Senate has to give its approval? What exactly would this bill say?
They have not revealed all of it yet. It could be a bill that puts sanctions back on, that puts additional sanctions on, and you know the president is obviously against that because he's afraid that'll sink the deal. Though there's lots of us who you know are kind of scratching our heads and still, as you said, saying what deal? This is not a good deal at all. But. Yeah, we'll have to wait and see what the Senate comes up with.
Yes, suffice it to say, your thoughts about the quote necessity of the Senate okaying this. I would have to think that the founding fathers, if they were to be transported forward and been briefed on all of this and what nuclear weapons are and gotten up to speed, that they would say, well, of course, this is what we meant by the advice and consent of the Senate regarding treaties. What would you think we meant? And I wouldn't have a good answer to that.
Yeah, this is pretty clearly, you know, I mean, the president and the executive branch are clearly have the authority to go out and negotiate with other governments to make agreements like this. But this one is a pretty darn significant one that most of my international lawyer friends, I'm not a lawyer, but most of them, you know, they just kind of shake their head and say, well, of course this rises to the level of being a treaty. You know, we make treaties about things that are less important and less specific than this. And frankly, it's just foolish on the part of the president to not try and get the Senate to support him. Now that may mean he'll have to do something a little differently than he wants, but you know, you don't spit in the eye of one of the three branches of the U.S. government and just say, I don't need you. I can do this on my own. That's just,
but he's been doing it with executive orders. He's been doing it with executive orders,
yeah,
about immigration. He amended the Affordable Care Act on the employer mandate, and the Constitution very specifically does not allow a president to amend the law. You can sign one into the law. You can veto one. That's it. I mean, he's been spitting in the eye of that co-equal branch from day one. So maybe his view is, why not spit again?
Oh, I think that's exactly it. He's... You know, he does not like to be disagreed with. He it just infuriates him. That's why he's so mad at, you know, certain senators and congressmen and was so mad at the Prime Minister of Israel, you know, to the point of acting like a petulant child about it. And he just, you know, is the kind of kid that's going to say, well, the heck with you then. I'll just take my ball and go. And that's kind of what he's doing. I'll just take my executive authority and go, and I don't care what you guys think. But that's
all right,
just wrong.
Yeah. Bottom line, what are the odds that Iran gets a nuclear weapon within the next 5 to 10 years?
Oh, I think it's pretty extraordinarily high.
I would agree.
I mean, I'm not going to put a percentage on it, but they want it. There's no doubt. I mean, you don't build intercontinental ballistic missiles to deliver rugs around the world. You know, that's an extraordinary expense. They're doing that. There's a reason, and the only really legitimate or sensible reason for them to do that is because they want to develop something to put on the ends of those ICBMs and deliver them to their enemies in the world, and we are one of those enemies, if not the predominant one.
And let's not forget that Iran already has missiles which can reach the southeastern tip of Europe. And the jump from intermediate-range ballistic missiles to intercontinental ballistic missiles is a very small jump.
It is indeed. But it is the kind of indicator their continuing investment and program to develop those longer-range missiles tells you something if you're not delusional like certain members of this administration who refuse to read that sign for what it really is.
Are we being set up for something other than the possession of nuclear weapons by this regime in Tehran is unacceptable? Are we being set up for, oh, well, hope you're nice with your new nuke? Is that what we're being set up for?
Well, I mean, if they get it, we are left with the choice of either going after them and going to war. And when we say that, I'm not just talking about, you know, a couple of thousand guys going in and doing low intensity conflict. We're talking about major, you know, nuclear war, because frankly, even with our conventional bunker busters, it would be hard to take out some of their facilities because they're buried so deeply in some pretty significant mountains. We have that choice, or we do exactly that. We say, oh, well, they got their nukes. I hope they behave nicely and try and watch them and be nice to them and maybe make more concessions to them. None of that sounds good to me, Jim.
Which is going to open up a huge arms race on two bases. Number one, all the other countries in the Middle East nervous of Iran getting a weapon in the first place. And number two, the realization by those countries, friend or foe, that the U.S. isn't going to do anything about it. I mean, if Iran gets one, and I'll go as far as to say when Iran gets one, then I could easily see any number of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Turkey, any number of countries going nuclear.
Oh, very much so. I mean, the Saudis could buy them from the Pakistanis today if they wanted to. The other regimes, particularly the Sunni regimes, you know, this whole response to the al-Houthis in Yemen is not about the al-Houthis. It's really about Iran. And you are seeing the Sunni regimes across the Muslim world banding together. They're not going to stand by and not have some countervailing capability if Iran gets a nuke. So, yeah, there'll be a nuclear arms race across the Muslim world that will further exacerbate this Sunni-Shia coalition building that's going on that's going to make for a heck of a big conflict when it blows up.
Mm-hmm. And what are the odds that a third nuclear weapon is fired in anger in the next 10 years? After Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Well, I think that's high as well. Either because the Iranians shoot it at Israel or at someone else, or that Israel or one of our other friendly countries say, we can't take a chance on these guys getting it. We're going to shoot first. And, you know, whether it's the Israelis who have their own or the Saudis who get one from the Pakistanis, I think that the likelihood's very high.
I would agree, and we'll talk with you a bit later off air. Stephen Bucci from the Heritage Foundation, back in a moment. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626 on the Bohannon Show, as we've been talking to Stephen Bucci, director of the Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy at the Heritage Foundation, and he is an adjunct professor of leadership at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, served for three decades as an Army Special Forces officer and top Pentagon official in the private sector. He was a lead consultant to IBM on cybersecurity policy, and maybe we should get him back if we do not as yet have our next guest lined up. Dr. Rachel Ehrenfeld, director of the New York-based American Center for Democracy and its Economic Warfare Institute. She is an authority on the hidden movement of funds through international banking and governments to fund terrorism. Dr. Ehrenfeld has advised banking communities, law enforcement agencies, and governments, including the U.S. Departments of Defense and Homeland Security. Her most recent book is an updated edition of Funding Evil, How Terrorism is Financed and How to Stop It, which is in paperback and ebook from Multi-Educator Incorporated. As we are talking in this portion of the program, with Iran celebrating its National Day of Nuclear Technology, in and of itself a rather auspiciously named occasion, with the two speeches from Iranian leaders, the president of Iran, not quite as august an authority figure as you might think, Hassan Rouhani, and then later the real power in Iran, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, both saying that this deal that has been worked out, quote-unquote, is actually one that would have to have all economic sanctions ending on day one, which is not certainly what we have been told was in that particular package. So whether or not this is the Iranians trying for even more out of the deal or are trying to wreck the deal is not entirely clear. A good place, I suppose, to start with Dr. Rachel Ehrenfeld. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. What do you think Iran is up to here? I mean, clearly, this is not what everybody signed on to. So are the Iranians trying to milk it for even more benefit to them? Well, or are they trying to torpedo the whole thing?
Well, nobody signed anything. What was proposed is as a framework for an agreement. So they signed on, they signed on for the framework. But there is really nothing there. So, and the Iranians want what the Iranians wanted all along.
As far as we know, that was never agreed to in any of the discussions that took place leading up to this. Granted, we're at the point of crossing T's and dotting I's, but I would think that after the various defenses that President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry have made about this deal, that it would be rather difficult for this administration to say, okay, no sanctions starting on day one.
Well, the Iranians have been saying, the Ayatollah never said that he agreed to any agreement without lifting the sanction. And they were just taking the Americans and the others along for a ride. And the Americans were really the one who initiated the whole circus. And they decided that, oh, we have this bully. Let's give this bully what he wants. Maybe we won't give everything, and it will appease him. Well, no. This bully, you give him a little finger, and he wants the whole hand. So there is no agreement, and the Iranians want what they wanted all along. And they have been, and they gained a lot of time in the meantime. So they probably, as many experts say, have enough uranium already. And allowing them to, even in this framework agreement, we don't know what's in the... We know some rumors or some details that we read in the papers, but we don't know what's in the framework. And the details have to be worked out. So the Iranians have been celebrating and calling for destroying the big Satan as usual. So why would anybody want to sit down with them unless they want to prove that they received a Nobel Peace Prize for a reason?
Yeah, an oak leaf cluster, as I refer to it, for the president's first Nobel Peace Prize, and for equally dubious reasons in that regard. Still, there have to be limits to the extent to which the United States will grovel, I have to think, and I would have to think, Even the president and the secretary of state at some point have to say, oh, well, we tried, and just bag the whole thing. How they could possibly tell the Iranians, sure, no sanctions from day one at this stage of the game. I mean, you would go from making them what they currently are, a symbol of weakness, all the way to being a laughingstock of the world.
I don't think that anything will stop this president from giving the Iranians what he wanted to do when he was running for election in 2008. He said he wanted to reset the relationship with Iran, meaning reset a relationship with the terrorist organization, with the terrorist state, is giving them, you are the first one who are offering something, instead of waiting for the Iranians to be on their knees and cave in and stop terrorism?
I grant you it's a ludicrous notion, but I've been saying that from day one. But I'm just simply wondering how far they are actually, this administration is actually prepared to go in this regard.
I think that they are ready to go all the way.
In other words, give them this, anything they want.
Yes, absolutely. This seems to be the direction all along.
It certainly does seem to be. I won't deny that. I just had to assume there was a limit somewhere. Maybe you're right. Maybe there's no limit to what they'll give in to.
I don't think there is any limit. And I think that if you look at what this administration has been doing all along, there is really no limit. They will not use any force. They want to negotiate. Well, first of all, we are an international community. Everybody is international, and we do everything. What, the UN will enforce sanctions? If something happens, the UN will... Well, first of all, the Ayatollah said, kind of took the whole thing off the table because he said, no, we won't sign anything without removing all the sanctions. And in the meantime, sanctions have been, there were all kind of compromises, giving them a little bit here, giving them a little bit there. The Europeans and others are actually engaged in businesses already with Iran. So, and the United States, even if Congress could have done something, which they cannot do, certainly not with this president, the Europeans, they cannot tell the Europeans what to do.
Stay with us. More to come on the Jimbo Hannon Show. We'll continue our discussion with Dr. Rachel Ehrenfeld, the director of the New York-based American Center for Democracy, at 1-866-50-JIMBO, as we look at the latest word from Iran on their National Day of Nuclear Technology. Both the nominal head of state, the president, and the actual head of state, the Ayatollah, both saying, all sanctions have to end on day one for any kind of nuclear deal to be worked out. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number. Back in a moment. Good to have you with us on the Jimbo Hannon Show, 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. We're talking with Dr. Rachel Ehrenfeld, director of the American Center for Democracy, online at acdemocracy.org and its Economic Warfare Institute, and looking at the Iranian decision to say we have to have all sanctions lifted on day one or there would be no nuclear deal. We'll look at a few other issues that affect our world, but before we leave this one, what do you think the odds are that Iran will get a nuclear weapon in 5 to 10 years?
So long? I think that Iran will have, may actually have a nuclear weapon this year. I think that Obama said, or somebody said that, if he has not signed this this agreement for the framework, and if we don't sign agreement, Iran would have a nuclear capability or nuclear weapon in 2 or 3 months. Well, as far as I understand, and it's logical that they probably have already enough enriched uranium to produce one, and the more centrifuges they have, the more they can actually, they can more rapidly gain even more. So I think that you are very optimistic.
No, the 5 to 10. Yeah, I would agree with you, actually. I gave that as an outside limit. That doesn't surprise me at all, what you said. I can easily see that they have enough right now. Something to keep in mind, that some think that once you actually set off a device successfully, that you're in the nuclear club, well, you may have, in fact, crossed a certain line of capabilities, but that doesn't mean that you, in fact, have enough weapons to be a threat. It means you've made a device. And the idea that the whole world should just sit there at that point and wait for that country to then produce 6, 10, two dozen, 5 dozen, and then they are a nuclear power. But at the point that a nation explodes a nuclear device, they are not a nuclear power yet in the sense that they've got a stockpile. That, to me, is the time when you eradicate the threat.
No. Well, you eradicate it before it actually begins.
Well, that would be better. That would be better, yes. I'll grant you that would be better, but since we're not going to do that, what do you think we will do when they set off a nuclear device?
This administration, nothing. This administration, nothing.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think
Absolutely, that is exactly nothing.
What we will do.
They will, and they will not do anything about Iran's involvement in terrorist activities the world over. The situation in Iran, in Yemen, is, pardon me.
Well, it's not, I'll tell you what, we're time for a break anyway. We'll take one and we'll continue our discussion. Again, Dr. Rachel Ehrenfeld, our guest with the American Center for Democracy, 1-866-50-JIMBO, back in a moment.
Hey, it's Jimmy Fallon. Here's what's happening later on The Tonight Show.
Now I thought I'd share some of my favorite My Crazy Family tweets from you guys. Here we go. This is from @TashSuper. She says, when we travel, my family pretends we're on The Amazing Race because my mom says it's good practice if we ever make it on the show. This one's from @NLDeSilva. She says, when we go to a Mexican restaurant, my dad cuts two holes in a tortilla, puts it on his face, and says, hello, Clarice.
Hello, Clarice.
This one's from @StephenLJacques. She says, my mom sneezed, blessed herself, then thanked herself. Bless you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This one's from @WhereAreMyMarbles. She says, when someone drops an ice cube on the floor, my mom yells, another one for the sink god. Then we all yell, all hail the sink god. This one's from @OzKarma. She says, when my family watches Jimmy Fallon, we clap when the audience does. Let's hear it for that family. Catch the Tonight Show tonight on NBC.
Welcome back. This is the Jimbo Haddon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-50-5466. Our guest, Dr. Rachel Ehrenfeld, director of the New York-based American Center for Democracy and its Economic Warfare Institute. Let's assume that Iran goes ahead and gets a nuclear weapon. You and I agree that's highly likely, maybe even imminently. In that event, who else in the Middle East will then make a headlong rush to acquire nuclear weapons with a realistic chance of getting them? I guess Saudi Arabia is at the top of the list.
Saudi Arabia from Pakistan.
And Egypt, Turkey, anybody else?
Well, we are talking about doing something in a hurry. So Pakistan has already nuclear weapons. So all the Saudis have to do is buy, and I think that they are developing also a nuclear plant for electricity, for power. I think that they will be the first one, and they could do it rather in a short period of time.
And the Pakistanis are ready to sell one to the Saudis?
The Saudis have paid a lot of money for the Pakistan nuclear development. So they
bought in advance. In other words, the deal when the Saudis financed the Pakistani nuclear program was, when we want one, you'll give us one. Is that how it works?
What exactly the deal was, I don't know, but we know that the Saudis have paid a lot of money. And actually, Khan, who developed the nuclear weapons in Pakistan, went ahead and really cheated the Saudis, because he actually sold also the nuclear, he helped the Iranians to develop their nuclear plant. So, but in any event, the Saudis will surely do something, and the Saudis are not happy, very happy at the moment, especially when Yemen is really on fire, and Iran is getting more and more involved, and now the Saudis are bombing Iran and the bombing.
Well, they're bombing,
Yemen,
the Houthis
and, yeah,
in Yemen. Yes,
and the Iranians have made all kind of declarations that this is wrong. So the next thing will be they will start bombing there. We don't know how this is going to end, but it doesn't look very good. We also have to remember that Iran has long-range ballistic missiles. They have submarines and they have all kind of ships that can, warships that can deliver nuclear weapons in many places.
Well, now that's an interesting thought. We certainly know that the Iranians have ballistic missiles that could reach certainly any part of Saudi Arabia or even parts of southeastern Europe. We know that Iran has submarines. Are you telling me that Iran has ballistic missile submarines? That's certainly new to me.
Well, I'm not an expert on submarines. I have read in some defense literature that they would have the capability. Moreover, we know, and there has been a talk about the missile launchers in Margarita Island in Venezuela. And the relationship, there isn't really a big problem to deliver something to Venezuela from Iran, from Tehran. The flights are going on all the time. We don't know what's going on there either. So, and from there, it will not be a very big distance to reach the United States. Any way we look at it, and you don't need very, you can have a ship and from there launch a missile.
Well, that's very true. In fact, you could do that now. I mean, you could, for example, you could take your basic Scud type of missile, which
absolutely
is really a World War II German V2 type of missile on steroids, a technology 75 years old. Mm-hmm. You could launch missiles carrying nuclear warheads into the atmosphere over the East Coast, the West Coast, and from the Gulf of Mexico over the central U.S. You could set off an electromagnetic pulse, which would effectively push us into the 19th century.
Yeah, but they can even hit I don't know, they can try to hit the United States as well. But if in case there is an EMP attack, well, I haven't seen much in the media about the power outage in D.C. It's like, well, not a big deal. And I haven't seen any, because one fuse had a problem. Well, it's very easy to take out the power in Washington. And
well, it wouldn't just be the power in Washington. You could, with three nuclear weapons, you could take out all of the power in the entire country.
Sure.
You could starve out significant portions of this country. You would destroy the United States as a major power in this world.
Yeah, but we see that while some private, since 85% of the electricity companies, power companies are owned privately, some of them are doing something in order to update their grids, but many don't. And I don't know where their shareholders are, but something should be done in order to encourage them to do that as fast as possible. And likewise, with cyber, this government has done absolutely nothing. And private companies should be doing more, and they can do more in order to secure themselves.
Yes, but we shouldn't have to wait for private companies to do it voluntarily. I mean, the federal government should be demanding this.
Well,
it's not just the power grid. I mean, for example, automobiles. I'm not sure there's been a car made in the last 30 years that would continue running after such an electromagnetic pulse attack.
Not only that, you don't even need an EMP attack. It's enough to stop communications between of cars, of medical devices, And everything is now working and moving even more so to Wi-Fi and the Internet.
Indeed. Well, unfortunately, the time has elapsed, but we thank Dr. Rachel Ehrenfeld, who is with the American Center for Democracy, online at acdemocracy.org. I'm Jim Bohannon, and this is Westwood One. Hi there and good evening. Welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Online, we're at jimbotalk.net. You can follow me on Twitter at Jimbo Talks. They recall word that Russian hackers apparently breached the White House computer system, but that it was thought to have not affected any classified systems. Well, as Evan Perez reports, that now seems to be not the case.
Russian hackers in recent months broke into sensitive parts of the White House email system. They could even see parts of the president's schedule not disclosed to the public in real time. The hackers are believed to be working for the Russian government. According to U.S. officials, they pulled off one of the most serious cyber breaches of U.S. government agencies. This breach is one reason why U.S. intelligence officials recently increased warnings about the cyber threat from Russia. The White House disclosed suspicious activity in its unclassified email systems in October, but officials say even unclassified emails contain sensitive information valuable to foreign spies. The hackers got in first by breaking into the State Department's email servers. Then they tricked someone into giving them access to the system serving the executive office of the president. Federal agencies are now warning employees to beware of so-called phishing emails. These appear to come from trustworthy email accounts, but actually contain malicious software, which gives hackers the ability to take over their computers. Evan Perez, Washington.
All right, we're going to be talking about this tonight, both from the standpoint of national security and also the standpoint of personal security. If the White House is vulnerable, what about us? What about you? What about me? Mark Goodman joins us tonight. He is a global strategist, author, and consultant who has spent his career at the intersection of law enforcement and technology. He served as a street police officer, senior advisor to Interpol, and futurist in residence with the FBI. He is the founder of Future Crimes Institute and holds the chair for policy, law, and ethics at Silicon Valley's Singularity University. He is also the author of Future Crimes, published by Doubleday, subtitled Everything is Connected, Everyone is Vulnerable, and What We Can Do About It. Mark, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine.
First of all, the reports from the White House updated now to indicate how serious that breach was. Are you surprised?
Not really, to be honest. The fact of the matter is that most computer systems, one way or another, have been violated. The trick is that there's never been built a computer system that could not be hacked. The former FBI director, Bob Mueller, famously said there are only two types of computers, those that have been hacked and those that will be. And whether it's your personal laptop, the store that you're shopping at, or even a government computer system, they're all hackable. There is no such thing as an unhackable computer. And so we'd like to think that our government information were better protected, but sadly, as we see, it is not.
Well, I would have to think that at some point, biometrics might make hacking a lot harder if, in fact, somebody had to replicate your fingerprints or your retinal scan or something of that nature. Does that not offer hope, maybe not of making something hack-proof, but of making things much more difficult to hack?
Potentially, but it also brings with it a whole host of other challenges. You know, when people talk about biometrics, they often suggest that it might be a panacea. But let's recall, when you are using your fingerprints to identify or your retina, you're not actually cutting off your fingers and storing them in a computer system. What you're doing is taking a photograph of your fingerprints, turning them into a computer representation, and storing that data in a computer. So like all other data, it too can be hacked. And we're seeing that lots of places are turning to biometrics for security. For example, 24-Hour Fitness has now started to use that to identify members when they check in to the gym, and NYU Medical Center is doing the same thing to identify patients. But the fact of the matter is, hospitals are breached routinely. Retailers are breached routinely. So if your credit card is stolen, for example, when Target is hacked, you can always get a new credit card number, but you cannot get new fingerprints. And so before we start taking all this biometric data, I think we ought to consider the implications of its leaked. They had a national biometrics program in Israel for all 9 million citizens there, and that database was subverted by an internal person who went ahead and got fired and then leaked the entire national biometric database. So you can go on the internet now in the dark web and find all the biometric data for all Israeli citizens out there. So it poses opportunities but also risks as well.
Then to what extent are we going to have to seriously consider the unthinkable, which is to say that some things are so sensitive and so important that we just can't commit them to the digital realm? That maybe like like personal finance or like serious government documents and the like, that we may have to go back to printing things on pieces of paper. I know that would make it very inconvenient for a lot of folks, but it's a lot more inconvenient if all of this is compromised.
Right. You know, we've seen that is our legacy. So all this data used to be stored on little pieces of paper. And you may recall that Anthem Blue Cross was recently hacked and, you know, tens of millions of patient records and information leaked out into the public domain. When that data was, you know, on a paper chart in your doctor's office, we didn't have to worry about those types of threats. But the aggregation of the data, the fact that Anthem Blue Cross didn't encrypt the data to protect it, and that it was all available online, meant that eventually, of course, it would leak. There are companies, actually, that don't put their most sensitive data online. Both Coca-Cola and Kentucky Fried Chicken don't take the secret recipes for Coke or for fried chicken and put it in any digital information system to protect it. They air gap it and write it down on paper and keep it locked away in a safe. And even the Kremlin recently, in response to the Snowden attacks, has now started to return to typewriters to type sensitive documents in the Kremlin. And they're not even electric typewriters. They're manual typewriters. So we are seeing some people explore those lesser technical avenues to protect their data.
I suppose there are some avenues of endeavor that would make that practically very difficult, if not impossible. I mean, we do a lot of things today that would be virtually impossible without the rapid transmission of and dissemination of and processing of information, right?
Yeah, I agree with you 100%, Jim. The challenge is that pretty much the world is being run by computers today. So if you look at all of our critical infrastructures, whether it be the power grid, sewer, water treatment, bridges and tunnels, 911 systems, air traffic control, ATMs, hospital records, they're all run by computers. And we could not do the work that we do today without computers. So if those computers go away, things would just stop. If you look at the stock market, but one example, the vast majority of stocks are not traded by people, human traders putting in, you know, bids to buy and sell. It's actually carried out by computers. The network complexities are so great today that a human being couldn't possibly manage all of the data. So technology isn't the problem. I am not anti-tech. I'm not a technophobe. In fact, I'm a technophile. I think technology can be awesome. But the challenge is we've wired the world, but we failed to secure it. And as such, we have an Achilles heel in our lives and in our society that we need to urgently address.
And we will certainly be doing that in the next portion of the program with our guest, again, Mark Goodman. He is the author of the book Future Crimes, published by Doubleday. How hopeless are things in this regard? 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the Jimbo Haddon Show. We're talking with Mark Goodman. He is a global strategist, author, and consultant. He is pretty much functioning at the intersection of law enforcement and technology. A good place to be these days, Mark. A growth industry, to be sure. And his book, Future Crimes, is published by Doubleday. Here's a call from Patrick in Longmont, Colorado. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, gentlemen. I love the show. First of all, I've got a question for Mike. First of all, I've never heard of the black web, so maybe you could explain that. I've got that question. And then I had an idea about, and I'm sure you've probably already thought of this, but why couldn't you set up through some kind of system, every week or every day, passwords get changed automatically, something to where these systems can't be hacked. I mean, the direction we're heading, I'm a veteran. I got a letter from the Veterans Affairs Administration about, 9-10 years ago. I think you might remember the employee took home his laptop, compromised my social security number and a whole bunch of other veterans. And this is just heading in the wrong way. And I think we got to try to find some way to fix it. So I'm going to hang up and listen to your response. Okay.
All right, Patrick, thank you for your call, and we're at 1-866-50-JIMBO. Is there any way that constantly changing, I don't know, maybe randomly generated passwords could be a solution here, Mark?
So great questions from Patrick. I'll start with the password question first. So there actually are some companies that are just starting to do exactly that. One of them is called Dashlane, and it is a password management program. The challenge with passwords is that they're incredibly hard to manage. We're all told that we need to have, 35-digit passwords, uppercase, lowercase. They want us to include a haiku and all this other information that's practically impossible. So because it's difficult to manage, we write these down on little pieces of paper and put them on our screen, which, of course, is not a great idea to put it on a Post-it note on your own computer. But there are tools out there. There's something called a password manager, which will use one master password that can protect all your other passwords. And there are great tools out there. One of those companies is called Dashlane. Another one is called 1Password, LastPassword, KeePass. Those will do. Broadly, what Patrick was saying is that it will maintain all of your passwords, and Dashlane has now just, I believe, introduced a feature where they are able to change your password for you periodically on the fly. So really good question. First question was regarding the dark web, and just to explain that briefly and what that means, most of us spend our time on what the professionals call the surface web. We are on Facebook and Amazon and ESPN, and we think we're on the internet, but it turns out that there's a much larger, more expansive internet out there than any of us realize, and it's actually 500 times larger than the surface web that most of us use. That other part of the internet that's known as the deep web is the part of the internet that Google cannot reach. So Google can't type passwords, and it can't get into websites that have password protection or firewalls or paywalls that are required. So that deep web contains academic databases like LexisNexis and the like, and that's 500 times larger than the surface web. And within that world, there is this dark web or secret web, and this is where criminals most frequently will ply their trade. You need special encryption software, a tool called Tor, T-O-R, which is called the Onion Router, and this will give you access to a whole other world where you can buy everything from stolen passports, stolen credit cards, child pornography, firearms, drugs. It's all available online if you know where to look.
Well, who maintains this? I mean, I would think that somebody has to maintain this, and it would be, frankly, assailable, that is to say, hackable in its own right, only this time hackable by law enforcement agencies.
Yeah, it's a great assumption. Believe it or not, I mentioned this Tor software, T-O-R, stands for the Onion Router, that was actually created by the United States government with the purpose of helping democracy and human rights activists overseas. So it uses very sophisticated encryption on a peer-to-peer network so that, democracy activists in China, Iran, North Korea, and elsewhere could bypass their national security firewalls and allow them to communicate with the outside world. So Tor uses a really strong encryption, and so it's hard to reverse engineer and figure out who's doing what. You may have recently heard of the case of the Silk Road. That was a young entrepreneur out of Silicon Valley by the name of Ross Ulbricht, and he was running the Silk Road, which was a criminal
criminal eBay where you could buy any of the things that I just mentioned. He ran it for almost 2.5 years and generated $1.2 billion in sales before it was ultimately taken down by the FBI many years later. Of course, the minute that website was taken down, then came Silk Road 2.0 and 3.0. So it's a major case of whack-a-mole, and the computer encryption and the ability to hide these websites makes it quite difficult for law enforcement to trace.
I guess the part of this I'm not fully understanding here, that for all of us legit folks out there, the government, the banks, the companies, retail outlets, and individuals, security is almost impossible. But the criminals here, they can't be touched. That strikes me as a contradiction. Well, if there are techniques that can hack us, then there ought to be also similar, if not identical, techniques that can hack them.
Well, there are two different things. One is going after the criminals to arrest them, and the other one is to go ahead and disrupt them and hack them. And basically, law enforcement, legitimate governments today, their goal is to make an arrest. So while we may be able to ultimately identify some of the people behind these websites, they often hang out in jurisdictions where the rule of law is weak and the local governments are corrupt. So we may be able, for example, to identify a hacker in China or Russia or, you know, Romania, someplace like that. But once we identify them, the opportunity to get them extradited and brought back to the United States is almost nil. It happens, but very infrequently. So they can disrupt our websites, and theoretically we could use the same tools to disrupt theirs, but for the most part that's not something that the government has explored to date.
If we're talking about the disruption of civilization, then the hell with niceties. Why don't we send out hit teams and assassinate these people? And I am not even speaking metaphorically or jokingly. I am absolutely serious.
Well, it's something that many governments have certainly considered and have thought about. I guess you'd have to do a cost-benefit analysis. So if somebody is...
Let's say our entire financial sector is torn down. I would say that if you spent $10 billion on this assassination program, it would be a bargain.
Right. So there are, you know, obviously our government, the United States government, does do targeted killing of people. We've seen this through drone strikes in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan, and other places. And there is a procedure in place for that. So if the government could go ahead and prove that somebody had an imminent attack planned against the United States that would result in loss of life or significant disruption to the American way of life, that's certainly something that government could explore.
Interesting thoughts. Let's reduce this down to the level of an individual here. For those of us who are just trying to survive in this world and do what we are theoretically supposed to do, and yeah, I changed my password already, this sort of thing, and what can we do? Starting with the premise, we're never going to be 100% secure. Maybe we won't even be largely secure. But what can we do to at least make our own lives a little bit more secure?
Well, that is a great question. And the good news is there is a ton that we can do. In Future Crimes, I've outlined what I call the update protocol. And it's 6 steps that people can take to vastly reduce their cybersecurity threat. It's based upon research carried out by the Australian Ministry of Defense. They studied tens of thousands of cyber attacks. And it turns out that if you follow those 6 steps, you can actually reduce your cyber risk by 85%, which is a massive, massive reduction. You know, the challenge for most folks is we know what security looks like in real space. If you leave for work in the morning, you don't leave the front door of your house or apartment wide open. When you drive to the local mall or Starbucks, you don't leave your keys in the car and the car running. But we don't generally know how to do that in cyberspace. So these 6 steps, if anybody goes to futurecrimes.com, they can find it there. They can download it. But broadly, they have to do with password management, which we just talked about, maintaining your software up to date, watching what you download and from where, using things like two-factor authentication, which means that you get a second password sent to you in real time before you log into a site. So with sites like Facebook and Gmail, Google, Dropbox, PayPal, you can actually download an app that, in addition to your usual password, will send you a one-time message via an SMS text or something like that on an app, so that without that additional 6 or 10-digit code, you won't be able to log in. This way, if hackers in Eastern Europe, China, or anywhere get access to your account password, they won't be able to log in without that limited term second factor for authenticating. So those types of things can be really helpful.
Okay, we'll continue our look at some very useful stuff here. Our guest again is Mark Goodman, the book Future Crimes, back in a moment. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO. Yeah, the White House got hacked, and they got some pretty sensitive information. Those were big-time Russian hackers, apparently. But there are lots of people out there who hack, and with seemingly great degrees of success. Who are the hackers, for the most part? You got spies, of course. You got common crooks. Sort them out for us, Mark Goodman.
Yeah, it could fall into any one of those categories. As you mentioned, I'll start with the sort of less organized. So there are your average everyday criminals that are going into cyberspace, but most folks have in their mind this vision of some sort of 17-year-old kid hacking away in his mom's basement. And according to a study by the RAND Institute, the average age of a cyber criminal today is 35, and 80% of criminal hackers are now affiliated with an organized crime group. So this has clearly gotten much more professionalized and much more organized. In addition to criminals, you have what are known as hacktivists. These are people who hack on behalf of a particular cause. You may have heard of LulzSec or Anonymous, those types of groups. And then there are nations that are certainly engaged in this, Russia, China. There are over 100 countries that have an information warfare program at the national level. And of course, we now know from Mr. Snowden and others that the United States obviously is also heavily involved in offensive cyber operations. So it could be any and all of the above.
Interesting. All right. Now, from the standpoint of just day-to-day larceny, what all can I do to see to it that somebody doesn't steal my money?
Right. Well, it depends where and how you're keeping your money. So, you know, mostly we used to be a cash society. That's obviously changed, and we've now moved towards credit cards of various types. The good news is if you have a credit card, you're mostly covered. It's $50, and most credit card companies will waive that. You certainly run a little bit more risk with debit cards. But you have to be aware of where you're keeping your money. And there is also new forms of currency, things like Bitcoin or PayPal as a fiat for other forms of currency, and each one of those has particular security benefits and security risks that come with it. We're seeing Apple Pay and Google Wallet, where you can also pay with your mobile phone and the like. So we have money in many, many different forms. I'll just throw out a quick tip for your listeners that may have or be running a small business. Notice that your bank accounts actually have different levels of protection. So if you have your money in a personal account, you're generally protected by FDIC. Up to $250,000, you generally have about 90 days to notice that your account has been hacked. But if you have a business account, the fact is that that is generally covered by a different law. That's covered by UCC, or Uniform Commercial Code. And depending on what agreement you signed with your bank, you may only have 24 hours to notify your financial institution that you've been hacked, or if not, you waive your right to get that money back. So,
what if it doesn't occur to me within 24 hours?
Well, of course, and for most people it doesn't, because they're busy running their small businesses. Then you are on the hook, and we're seeing organized crime groups realize that. You know, an average small business may have a much larger bank account. A person might keep $5,000 or $10,000 in their bank, or maybe just $1,000, but small businesses can keep $25,000, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 in there. And we're seeing hospitals, volunteer fire departments, Boy Scout troops, and then dry cleaners and pastry companies, you know, cookie makers, and these people are increasingly being ripped off. And when they're reaching out to their financial institution for assistance, they're being told, too bad. So if you have a personal account, let's just say with Citibank, for example, Citibank is on the hook if that money is stolen. So they're going to expend energy and effort to go after the bad guys. But if you have a small business account, it is up to you. And the banks are generally not nearly as helpful because you're on the hook. They are not. And so we're seeing lots of small businesses, startups, and others that are having to eat those losses. And there have been many banks sued as a result of that. So just a tip is watch how much money you keep in those accounts and watch them very, very closely. Look at your agreement with your bank and see exactly what your responsibilities are to keep yourself protected.
Just one thought here about the term you mentioned a moment ago before we move on. I even did a show on bitcoins one time, and I must say I came out of it understanding hardly anything, except that I certainly knew there was no reason in the world that I ever needed to have any association whatsoever. To me, it sounds like one of these time wasters that we can do this, therefore we will do it. The curse of the techno geeks. Why would anybody indulge in bitcoins? I mean, especially with the lack of a safety net that you just outlined. I mean, we have money already.
Right. So there's several reasons why you would do it. I'll talk about criminals first. When I talked about that Silk Road earlier that did $1.2 billion in business, the only currency that they accepted was Bitcoin because it was hard to trace and therefore very, very good for criminal purposes. So you will see people using things like that. There are other people who have difficulties moving money around the world, and this could be a legitimate reason for using Bitcoin. You know, there are many migrant workers here in the United States that try to send money back home, and all those companies that facilitate those transactions take huge chunks of, you know, very poor people's money that they're sending back home at great cost to them. So Bitcoin theoretically could serve as a way to disintermediate those people and save on those costs. And other people are finding it convenient, you know, just wave your phone and pay. But as you rightly pointed out, there are certainly risks with it. One of the largest Bitcoin thefts to date was against a company called Mt. Gox, which was basically like a Bitcoin bank, an exchange, and they got hacked, and $436 million of Bitcoin was stolen from them. So when you consider the average, you know, in-person bank robbery in the United States only nets about $4,300, according to the FBI, and people face life imprisonment for that, going after Bitcoin seems like a really great idea if you are a criminal. So there's pluses and minuses. There's lots of legitimate companies that are accepting it nowadays. I think you can buy pizzas with it. You can buy coffee in San Francisco. You can buy and book travel with certain sites. So, you know, companies want to be able to make their products accessible to as many customers as possible, and they're kind of rushing towards the Bitcoin world. But as you rightly point out, there's a lot of issues that need to be addressed first.
Well, that certainly satisfies Bitcoins in my book. If you want to play with it, go. Burn yourself. I cannot imagine, frankly, the need for me ever again to even say the term. 1-866-50-JIMBO. And back to things that the rest of real people actually worry about here. Mark Goodman is our guest, and he's got a slew of them in the book, Future Crimes. Back in just a moment. Thank you for being with us on the Jimbo Hannon Show. Our guest is Mark Goodman, the author of Future Crimes. It is a cautionary tale, to say the least. Doubleday, the publisher. I note here one thing that you write. To date, the major threat to big data has been their theft and leakage, but that's only the beginning. As we move forward, we will encounter dangers that may prove to be even more perilous. Unauthorized alteration of the information upon which the world depends to run its daily activities. Okay, tell us more.
Well, we think about cyber threats, most folks, based upon what they hear in the media. So we hear Target was hacked and JP Morgan was hacked and Anthem Blue Cross was hacked, and we say, oh, people have stolen our data, or they've stolen our identities, or we've stolen our credit cards. But that's probably one of the best case scenarios is having the data stolen. There's a much more insidious harm that could occur, which is having your data changed or altered. Think about somebody who goes into a hospital for an operation and their blood type is changed in a computer system, or you go to do a trade on Wall Street and somebody changes how much you spend or at what price, or they change the balance of your bank account for the worse, or even look at some of the government databases that are out there, whether or not somebody is posted on a watch list, on the no-fly list, or to the opposite, whether or not guilty people are released from prison in future crimes. I cite several different examples where hundreds of prisoners have been released across the world because somebody hacked into the system and said, okay, you can set John or Jane free right now. So we depend on these systems, and it's not just, you know, these small computers, it's also big computer systems. Computers run all our critical infrastructure. So think about a water plant. Somebody could change the chemical mixture of how our water is purified, and rather than putting out clean water, they could put out poisoned water, or the same with agricultural or the manufacture of drugs that save people's lives. So all of these systems are subject to alteration and being hacked, and so we need to be aware of that possibility and take steps against it.
How much of the hacking has nothing to do with making an illicit profit or stealing national secrets, but just boils down to I'm an irresponsible techno geek, and I'm just going to I do this as a hobby.
Right. So that is actually how a lot of this hacking started out. If you go back to the early days in the 60s and 70s, most hackers did it for the laughs. They did it to prove that they could break into NASA or the White House. If you remember that movie War Games with Matthew Broderick, right? He was just there to play a game and accidentally hacked into the Pentagon. So there is that element that likes to see if they can do it for what hackers call the lulls, L-U-L-Z, meaning for the laughs of it all. There is that. I want to be clear that not all of this is motivated by financial gain. We talked about some terrorist attacks earlier. We talked about nation states hacking. And even, you know, all of our interpersonal troubles that we experienced in real life are starting to migrate online, whether it be stalking of an ex-boyfriend or girlfriend, an ex-spouse. We're seeing that. We're seeing a really terrible trend with cyberbullying. There's some statistics in the book where something like 50% of all high school kids have considered suicide as a result of cyberbullying or some statistic like that. Those were the rough numbers. The more precise ones are in the book. So we're seeing that. We're even seeing something called revenge porn, where, you know, all those naked pictures that certain people are taking and sharing with their boyfriends or girlfriends, when people break up, they're posting all of those images online as well. And, of course, that data doesn't go away. So all of the human function and dysfunction that we have in real space is being translated in cyberspace.
Do the big people have answers for all of this that we don't? For example, I would like to think, honestly, that the White House can resort to some kind of defense that is beyond what I have. It'd be nice if I had it, but I would like to think that, you know, I mean, let's face it, in the big scheme of things, if my identity is stolen, it's a real pain for me, but it doesn't upset the universe, whereas some of the stuff we're talking about here would certainly upset the universe from the perspective of this whole planet. So do the White Houses and the big players, countries and companies, have answers the rest of us don't?
I don't believe so. I think that they may have bigger budgets. They may take more steps. But most large corporations are woefully unprepared for the cyber attack. In future crimes, I mentioned a study by the U.S. Secret Service and Verizon that shows that only 6% of corporate attacks or attacks against corporate networks, data breaches, are actually detected by the companies themselves. That means 94% of the time when a company is hacked, it's because your customers are complaining or the FBI comes knocking on the door. The average time to detection for a data breach these days is 211 days. That means for nearly 7 months, the bad guys are living inside a company's network before that company actually identifies them. We spend massively on cybersecurity, but it's not clear we're getting really good return on investment for our of what we're spending on all of this. I would love to say that the White House is better protected, but we've seen that their elements of their systems have been hacked. You were talking earlier about the State Department, we know not only have they been hacked, but they've had difficulty for months and months and months chasing the bad guys out of their system. Corporate systems have been penetrated. The New York Times has been penetrated. You know, the Associated Press. The list goes on and on. Major financial institutions like J.P. Morgan Chase have been hacked. So this goes back to what I was saying earlier about no system being impenetrable. And we're wiring the world. We're really, really good at connecting stuff. We will have this thing called the Internet of Things coming online. If we think our Internet is big today, we're about to connect 200 billion new devices to the Internet by 2020, according to the Intel Corporation. Cisco says it'll only be 50 billion. But we can't protect the computer servers we have. We can't protect our laptops, our smartphones. So what happens when every refrigerator and Xbox and toaster and automobile and pacemaker and elevator and airplane go online? That's the trend that we're on. And not only will these raise a variety of security risks, but they'll also raise a variety of privacy questions. Recently, Samsung came under fire in the UK because they updated their smart television. So many folks today will have a smart TV. You get to stream shows like Netflix directly on your television, which connects to the Internet. But those TVs are now effectively computers, and they're hackable. So Samsung just updated their latest model of their smart TV so you could use a voice interactive system. So rather than, you know, pushing down on the buttons on the remote control, which apparently is a pain to some people, you can just talk to your TV, TV on, TV off, channel 7, volume up, that type of stuff. And they had to update the terms of service for their smart TV, and they said, be aware that when you talk to your TV, we're recording everything you say, we're sending it to a third party in another country, and we save this data. And they also say, in order for this feature to work, your television will be listening to you in the background 24/7. So they literally came out and said, if you have anything sensitive that you want to discuss, please don't talk about it in front of your television. So if you and your wife are in your bedroom late at night, your TV's listening. And if anybody's read the book 1984, we know how this ends. So all of these new devices that we're adding to the network are going to vastly expand what I call our threat surface area, the number of ways that bad guys can get into our lives. And that's why I think it's quite urgent that we begin to address these threats now.
More to come back in a moment. Welcome back to the Jimbo Haddon Show. Mark Goodman is our guest, author of the book Future Crimes, published by Doubleday, subtitled Everything is Connected, Everyone is Vulnerable, and What Can We Do About It? All right. To the extent that we can and still function in this world today, how can we stop this world I want to get off? Because I am not interested in the latest toy makes my geeky goose pimples all hot and tingly. I just want to survive in this world, and if my convenience is cut or even some options I didn't want in the first place are cut, that's fine. I don't need it. The only thing I really have to do is I have a job, and that requires that I have some digital interactions with a few folks. But other than that, I don't care to venture into this area any more than I have to. How much can we get off of this world?
Well, as you rightly pointed out, you know, technology is invading every area of our lives. So pretty soon you won't be able to avoid a lot of this tech. You know, when you go to your bank or you go to open up a cable bill or sign up with the gas company, they're all asking for your email address. When you go to apply for a job, one of the first things that the HR person is going to do is look you up on LinkedIn and Facebook and try to figure out exactly who you are. So more and more you need to participate in this digital society to partake fully in it. I remember just a couple of years ago, I wasn't on Facebook, and one of my friends had a birthday and said to me, hey, why didn't you come to my birthday? And I said, why didn't you invite me? He said, well, I posted it on Facebook. So, you know, I wasn't on Facebook. I was used to getting at least an email invitation. And if you don't partake in these worlds, then you start missing out on events and other types of activities.
So what does it take? Do we have to suffer a major disaster in which, let's say, 5 or 6 million of us lose our life savings, or major portions of the U.S. military are compromised? I mean, do we have to, is that what it takes to get our attention? I guess we have to do something, because it sounds like the attitude of this country is, hey, we're having too much fun. Don't rain on our parade. So does it have to rain a hurricane on our parade to finally stop this nonsense?
Right. I mean, that's a question I ask myself all the time. One of the things that I observe is that, you know, there are evidence of these massive cyber attacks all around us, and we're all busy, and we've got to get the kids off to school and, you know, go to work, and we have a million things to do. But, you know, if it's your profession, as it is mine, to look at these issues, you can clearly see the signs are all abound. William Gibson, who wrote the novel Neuromancer, famously said, the future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed, right? Electrical grids have been hacked. The GAO just put out reports about China and others getting into the U.S. electrical grid, right? We had 100 million people have their accounts compromised at Target and Sony PlayStation. Before that, the White House has been hacked. The Department of Defense has been hacked. Massive amounts of intellectual property have flown from the United States into China. So the signs are all about. I'm hoping that we don't have to have a catastrophic event. Why wait until then, right? Why don't we focus?
Because we will.
Yeah.
Because we will. I mean, I admire your call for rationality and reason to prevail, but we all know it won't. I'm thinking it's going to take just such a disaster.
Well, let's prepare for that disaster now, and I'll just throw out one example. You know,
unfortunately, I'll tell you what. Can you stay to the next section of the next hour?
Of course.
Very good. Then we will do just that and offer some more thoughts from our guest. He is Mark Goodman, and the book is Future Crimes. I'm Jim Bohannon, and this is Westwood One. Hi there, and good evening, good morning, and welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Online, find us at jimbotalk.net, and you can follow me on Twitter, at JimboTalks. And we would note, by the way, if you're just joining us, we're continuing our conversation with Mark Goodman. He is a global strategist, author, and consultant, and he works with crime and technology, trying to help save people from digital crime, if you will. And in the course of doing that, he's served as a senior advisor to Interpol and a futurist in residence with the FBI. He's the founder of Future Crimes Institute, and also is a man who has written Future Crimes, Everything is Connected, Everyone is Vulnerable, and What We Can Do About It, which is published by Doubleday. We were taking a look before the last break intervened at the top of last hour about some of the things that we can, in fact, actually do, and I was looking at the extent to which we can sever ourselves from some of these things that are making us more vulnerable. For example, TV sets that listen to us. I don't need a TV set that overhears what I'm saying. If it shows me pictures and sound, that's fine. And if that's not 2015 technology, but 05 technology or 1995 technology, whatever. I don't have to have the latest every little toy, and that's what most of these things are, toys of no great importance to the consumer, when they make me more vulnerable than I already am.
Well, I totally understand what you're saying, Jim, but the thing that's interesting is that the marketplace is actually limiting our choices, right? If you want to find an old school digital or regular, you know, TV with a tube in it, those are impossible to come by anymore. They just don't manufacture them, and you'll see increasingly that TVs that don't have an internet connection are harder to buy. You can't find a cell phone today. They have some dumb phones left, so-called dumb phones, because they don't connect to the internet, but the majority of them do, right? So increasingly, the choices that we used to have to opt out of this don't exist anymore. Take, for example, the automobile. Let's say that you said, I don't want a car with any chips in it. You can't buy a car manufactured after 2010 that doesn't have at least 200 computer chips in it that manage everything from the airbag to the cruise control to the radio system and the like. And of course, we're now seeing examples of cars being hacked. Leslie Stahl just did a great piece on 60 Minutes where she demonstrated, but I've been writing about this for years. So cars really aren't cars anymore. They're computers that we ride in. And you can go ahead and drive a 65 Chevy, but eventually they will die out. And, you know, our choices are being limited by the marketplace. So if people want to have and make different choices, they need to speak up and demand that companies continue to produce them. But rather than...
Or the government needs to do something. I mean, again, if there's a threat here, I'm not prepared to go over the cliff just because I happen to be surrounded by a lot of vacuum-headed fellow consumers. That's not acceptable to me. There ought to be an option out there, and I'm not sure what we have to do. Sign up probably on some Facebook page, which is another step in the digital direction, saying that we are people who would like to divorce ourselves from some of the idiocy here and some of the vulnerability. I'm not sure how you get that message across unless... If it takes this, then I'm willing to go down that route, and that is the government that says you will make this option available. And if you don't, we'll shut you down or tax you to death or what have you. I would like to think that a, quote, marketplace works here, but I am not prepared to be a part of the least common denominator that's decided to jump off the cliff like some digital lemming.
Well, I applaud you for that, and there are lots of other folks that agree with you, and there are organizations that are working on, you know, fighting some of these cyber threats and even some of the various privacy issues that we've seen out there. There are organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the Center for Democracy and Technology that are raising concerns certainly about the privacy issues and even the security issues around these technologies. I do want to be clear that technology is not bad, right? Technology will bring billions of people out of poverty. It will help educate the world. It will radically extend life and reduce infant mortality. It's all how we use it. Let's go back to the first technology, which was fire. You could use it to cook your food, keep your cave warm at night, or to burn down the village next to yours. The challenge is that we have a lot of 21st century fires that most folks don't realize. So that's what I want to draw attention to. Technology can be awesome. Our technological future can be awesome. But the average Joe and Jane are going to have to get off their butts, like you just did, and speak up for this better technological future and get involved. If not, don't be surprised when very large technological corporations go ahead and program around you and create tools that may not be in your best interest, but certainly are better for their corporate bottom line. And the same goes both with foreign governments as well as our own government.
I am reminded of a story that came out a few years ago, a little hypothetical, in which let's say that we get that long-awaited visit from the stars. Space aliens show up in their big flying saucers, and they have come to share some of their super technology with us. And they offer to give us an invention that they've had that will totally revolutionize our lives, that will make... getting around much more easy and convenient. It will have a completely revolutionary effect on the transportation of goods and services. It will totally change our lives and radically, positively so. And all they ask in return for this invention is the annual blood sacrifice of 40,000 of our fellow citizens. Oh, would we tell these space aliens where to get off, and don't even bother us again with such ridiculous bloodthirstiness. And then, of course, along came the automobile.
Right.
I mean, the simple fact is that sometimes we do make bargains with the devil. Now, I would argue that on balance, yes, the automobile claims a lot of lives, but it also probably has made a lot of lives possible just by virtue of the transportation of food, for example.
I think the automobile is a great example, because let's look at how the automobile changed in the 60s. So, you know, politics aside, if you look at the number of people killed in road accidents in the 1950s and 60s, there were tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Americans that died every year in car accidents. And one guy spoke up and said, hey, you know, these cars that GM and Ford and Chevy were making are dangerous, and we need things like seatbelts and, you know, better construction of the vehicles. And the guy was Ralph Nader, and he wrote a book called Unsafe at Any Speed, and he was kind of labeled a heretic by the industry, but eventually those safeguards got put into our automobiles, and hundreds of thousands of lives were saved. And recently the CDC and the U.S. government credited, you know, those changes to vehicles as being the most significant public health achievement and accomplishment of the 20th century, saving more lives than all other steps put together. So, you know, in the same way that Ralph Nader might have looked at Ford and Chevy and GM and all these other companies as, you know, the impossible huge mega corporations, you know, we have Facebook and Google and all these other companies that are doing things with our data, which, you know, they have a business plan. And if you understand their business plan and agree to it wittingly, then go ahead and use Facebook and enjoy it. But when a company takes 10, 20, 30,000 words in their terms of service to explain to you how they're using you and using your data, it's probably not in your best interest. So I totally support, you know, free market, and I think these companies are great, but there are some downsides, and I think people need to understand them so they can make informed decisions.
All right. Bottom line, if you were in charge of national cyber policy for everybody, government, business, individuals, and the like, your word was law, and you wanted to make things as good as can be made, which is to say, we can't totally tear apart the 21st century, but at the same time, we have left ourselves wide open to great vulnerabilities. Balancing everything, what would be the Mark Goodman edict on how we dealt with this?
A few things off the top of my head, and these are the last three chapters in my book where I talk about solutions. First and foremost, we need much better software. The reason why all of these hacks are possible is because most of the coding is pretty poor. There's very little attention to security. So I think we need to address that significantly and secure this systems up front. Most companies are not focused on that, and there are some market incentives that are completely misaligned where they focus on shipping software rather than securing it. So, you know, when that happens, maybe folks need to be made accountable for that poor software. I think we need to get much more serious about the threat. I think we can learn a tremendous amount from the public, right? The criminals are crowdsourcing their crimes. There's tremendous innovation in the general public, whether it be, you know, an 80-year-old woman in Mississippi or a 14-year-old kid in New York. We don't know where the answers are going to come from, so I would open this up. I would also say that we need to have a National Cyber Reserve Corps. We have Reserve Army, Navy, Marines, we have reserve police officers, we've got FEMA for disasters. We have no reserve corps for when this eventual cyber disaster occurs. Let's take 100,000 people, put them through the background process, clear them, and get them on board. I think that we need to have incentive prizes, right? Let's build a competition, put up a $20 million prize. I'm working with the XPRIZE Foundation to do that for a cybersecurity XPRIZE, where we can drive innovation just as they did with the Lindbergh Prize when he flew across the Atlantic. And lastly, I think that we need to start thinking about a Manhattan Project for cybersecurity. At the height of World War II, when it became clear the Nazis were going to build a nuclear weapon, the Allies got together and we had 120,000 people working in secret around the clock to build that safer future for our nation. We face an existential threat, not in the sense of a nuclear weapon, but think about what this world would look like without electricity, without water, financial transactions, and the like. We need to...
We would not be able to survive. You're not just talking about inconvenience. You're talking about the fact that 315 million people in this country survive because of this technology.
Stripped of that technology,
90% of us probably would die, many from starvation.
Well, I agree with you, and that's why I think now's the time to get serious. The last part, and I'll leave you with this, is that we've solved really complex things before, right? President Kennedy said in the 1960s, by the end of this decade, we're going to put a man on the moon. We did that, right? We as human beings, we as Americans, are capable of phenomenal achievement. if we're focused and if we put our mind to it. And that's what I'm calling for. Now's the time to get focused. We are at a punctuated moment in our nation's history, in our human history, as this technology drives forward. The time to understand it and take it back and make sure that it works to the greatest benefit of the largest number of people is right now. And that's what I hope to do with Future Crimes, is educate folks and discuss these problems and these opportunities.
Mark Goodman, and let's hope that a lot of people are listening and reading. The book is Future Crimes, published by Doubleday, subtitled Everything is Connected, Everyone is Vulnerable, What Can We Do About It? Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tim.
Mark Goodman, all right, and we'll be back with more on the Bohannon Show in just a moment. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Online, we're at jimbotalk.net. You can follow me on Twitter, at Jimbo Talks, as we turn to Robert in Suffield, Ohio. Hello, Robert.
Hello. I was listening to the gentleman that just was on there. I was kind of interested in what he was saying, but, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm from the past or anything, but I don't subscribe to all this technology. I mean, I think technology is fine, and I think it has its place, but what bothers me is the fact that they want to shove it down our throats in every aspect of our life, and that bothers me. And I don't have, I'm not into computers, not that I just don't, I think it's taking away all our privacy and our civil rights. And as far as cars go, now I don't know how dedicated you are. I drive older cars. I take them apart and rebuild them when they need to be fixed. And I have one newer car, but that's it. And I'll tell you, you're a very intelligent person, and I don't know how dedicated you are. But you can take from different performance shops and places. They make bodies, they make frames, they make everything now where you could build a car the way you wanted it and have it done cheaper than what you could buy a new car for that wouldn't be as high a quality of parts in it as what you could build yourself.
Well, first of all, I'm certainly not in a position to, quote, build a car, nor are 99.99% of the people out there. In terms of cheaper, when you talk about automobiles today and the mass production of the parts and the like, and you're talking about virtually putting together a custom-made car, I'd be very surprised that a vehicle such as you describe could be built today for less than $50,000 or $60,000, because there's no assembly line turning out this material. It would be virtually custom built, and that would require a lot of expense.
Well, you'd have to be fairly, you know, knowledgeable yourself to do some degree of it yourself.
But well, in that case, that's an answer for less than 1% of the population. I'm happy for you, Robert, but for most of us, that's not an option. I mean, I couldn't go out and build my own car any more than I could take out my wife's appendix. Like I said, I'm
sure
glad for you.
Could. You don't think you could, but you...
Well, I'll put it this way. I am not really interested in doing it. I mean, what would I have to do? I mean, I would have to spend weeks and weeks learning stuff, and then I would have to turn part of my house into a garage. I mean, there has to be a better answer than that, honestly.
Well,
I'd rather go out and find a vintage automobile from the late 70s or something and pay somebody else to renovate it.
That's very good, too. I mean, I have done that. I have older cars that I have acquired that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But again, I'm certainly not a Luddite, and I'm sure you're not either. The notion of technology being shoved down our throats is largely a market-driven factor. Let me ask you this: you sound like the kind of guy who might be in the market for this. Do you own a typewriter?
Do I? No, I don't.
You don't. Well, what do you write on? Don't tell me you use a word processor. That's just one step away from the internet.
I write on paper with a pencil or an ink pen.
you write on paper with an ink pen. Well, that is not an option, I think, for many of us. But I was just going to note that if, in fact, you were trying to find a typewriter, it's not easy to do. I have a couple of old typewriters, both in disrepair, and there are very few places around that can fix typewriters. And I'm not prepared to take several months of my life to learn how to fix or build my own typewriter. And there are many things I do that would be grossly inconvenient to sit around and write with longhand. I don't need hand cramps that bad to do that. So I can sympathize with you, I suppose, in principle, Robert, but most of us are just not in a position to do that. I think there have to be better answers somewhere. But in any event, I thank you for your call. It's something that we are, to a certain extent, being dragged into. I don't deny that. There's a certain amount of dragging that's taking place here. As I say, there are, for example, I'm encouraged to use social media at this network. Is that really a part of my job? Well, I guess it's considered to be by many people these days, and so I tweet occasionally. That's pretty much as far as I'm prepared to go. I mean, to wallow in some of this stuff, I just find pointless in the extreme. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number, 1-866-505-4626. How many of you feel like Robert, that you have been, in fact, browbeaten into some of the levels of cyber relationships that you have that aren't really necessary? Some things are necessary. If you're going to have a bank account, you have to deal with their computers, but other things, not so much. Back in a moment. Good to have you with us on the Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. And by now, I suppose it's fairly clear that I am not somebody who has 3.0 of something, and I have got to have 4.0. And when 5.0 comes out, I'll wait in line for 24 hours in cold weather to get it. I just find that the very depth of ignorance, seriously, just because somebody has got the iPhone 12 or what have you, doesn't mean I have to have it. My iPhone does quite fine. But there are some things where it's difficult to function in the modern world unless you go along with some of this. William in Cleveland. Hello, William.
Hello, Jimbo. I just want to say thanks for taking my call, first of all. And
sure.
I want to respond to your remarks that I agree. I ain't a Luddite. I agree technology has got great things. For instance, Jimbo, I'm a military man. And I love, for instance, how social media exposes that stolen valor stuff. Without that, we have these guys walking around in the uniform of our men and women. However, I'm afraid that, you know, you have a good point that the market forces, you know, will make it so popular. But however, you got to consider the fact that sometimes when whole school districts and school systems, a handful of people choose to push this technology, these iPads and stuff for our children, these laptops, these Air Macs and MacBooks and Mac Pages, that they push it into them, and they get used to it, and they go and live their lives in this cyber world. And that isn't necessarily marked the forces. The whole society gets wrapped up into this technology, but only a handful of people chose that, and the kids grow up on it, and that's like the bread and butter.
Well, of course, young people have been in the forefront of most of this from day one. For one thing, if you're of that age, it's new, it's got to be good. A lot of people lack the maturity to buy into that. I would point out what ought to be obvious, I think, to most people with a brain, but apparently isn't, and that is just because something is new doesn't automatically mean it's better, and something that is better doesn't automatically have to be new, but a lot of people do feel that way, and I'm sure there are many people. We've got folks on the show tonight who admit that part of the reason they're dragged into this world is because of their kids. If you want to really converse with your kids, you almost have to be logged on, as it were. So I recognize that that's part of the situation here, and I don't, I guess, really stand out outside just wailing and moaning about this. It came up tonight, and then I hadn't really expressed myself on the subject, and I'm glad to talk with people like you who express themselves as well about it. It bothers me. I can't say that I look upon it as something that will be fixed. I expect to be dragged inexorably further down the same road. I mean, I don't see any way around it. I'm not going to go out and live in the woods someplace without electricity or running water and hunt my food. I'm not going to do that.
No, me neither, Jim, bro. What I see is exactly what you said. You know, if you got a bit of a brain, you ain't going to be caught up in the next big thing, the next month after you bought one thing. But the thing is, a lot of our kids, you know, their cerebral cortex, whatever it's called, that decision-making part of the brain ain't formed until you're fully, you know, 23, 25. And they get wrapped up in it, so they're hooked up in it in school, and then their brain ain't fully formed, the decision-making process. And like you said, Jim, it comes down to parents. They always be there. It's a new tool. It's a new toy. You know, we got toys growing up, too. Your parents got to control them. But, you know, you were 100% right, because, you know, it comes down to us. You recognize the problem. It's a new problem. It's a new world. That's all it is. We got to be careful. You got to care for your own family like that, Jimbo.
Well, I appreciate your thoughts, William, and I thank you for your call. You simply have to have some measure of balance, some measure of reason about all of this. And again, I'm reevaluating some of the things that I do digitally. Is there a point to this? And in many cases, I find the answer is no, not really. Thank you, William. Let's go to Scott. He calls in from Phoenix tonight. Good evening, Scott.
Hey, how's it going? I just wanted to comment on basically the whole evolution of technology and how people should interact with it. And really what we need to do is we need to take personal responsibility for the repercussions of our actions in using the technology itself, if that makes any sense. For instance, you used an analogy earlier, you know, you wouldn't fully immerse yourself, but it is a way of life. For instance, if you needed to evolve, you don't need to evolve to live on land just because it rains and have gills. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Well, let me put it this way. I am aware of the fact that it would be possible for me to divorce myself from technology. I wouldn't still have this job, and I probably wouldn't have electricity, and I wouldn't have running water or sewer. I'd be out in the middle of some national forest someplace that living like the Unabomber. And I'm not prepared to do that. I'm not prepared to do that, Scott. I'm just I'm not going to turn this into some holy crusade and destroy my entire life to do this.
Well, it's just that society has made it so that in order for us to live the life that we do, and the market has dictated in order to be successful, that you must use technology. Mm-hmm. However, we have to when we use technology, we have to understand the repercussions of our actions in using it, such as if you use the internet, you have to know that your privacy is not 100% safe at any given time. Just like,
I accept that. In my case, I have to use the internet, and I have seen so far no serious breach of my privacy. So I consider that a trade-off. But in other words, I've done exactly what you've said. I've considered the repercussions. On the one hand, if I don't use it, I won't have my job. I won't have my income. On the other hand, I do use it, and nobody's done anything to me yet in terms of my loss of privacy. So I weigh the options, and it's worth it.
Yeah, and you and everybody, every person has to make that own decision for themselves. They can't rely on outside sources to give them their own opinion. And that's what that was my original point, was you have to take personal responsibility in how you use and utilize technology in your own life. And only you can make that choice.
Well, only you can make the values. Only you can make the value as to what is worth more. Now, certainly others, such as our guest earlier, Mark Goodman, can provide you with the raw information necessary for you to make that decision. And I'm glad that he was able to do that. But yes, in the final analysis, Scott, you're exactly right. Each of us must decide based on our own values of what route we follow. For me, it's an easy choice. I like this job. It's a lucrative job. I'm not giving up this job. And so far, my intersection with technology has had no serious downside. I haven't lost my identity or anything like that. But you're right. We need to weigh the repercussions, and I agree with you. That's an excellent way to put it. Let's go to Bob. He's in Gainesville, Georgia tonight, listener to WDUN Radio, where I just visited, as a matter of fact, earlier in the week. Good evening, Bob.
Oh, good evening, Jim, and I enjoyed that program very much.
Thank you.
I have a couple of suggestions to make. One is a real simple, practical one. Much of the risk for individuals, and the same thing would apply for companies, is software, and Mr. Goodman pointed that out, software that's really not, tamper-proof. It just can be hacked. And, we have had for decades Underwriters Laboratory in this country, which rated, the safety and had certain standards, and there are other industry standards or organizations which rate things. And I think we could benefit from the same thing in software. I mean, all these kids, here's the latest app, or it just came out this morning. I got to have it on my phone this afternoon. But if there was such a system with a simple numerical rating system, it could guide consumers into weighing the risk. You know, if something had a 35, risk, I'm not going to get it. You know, if it's got a 90 or above, maybe I'll consider it. If it's 98 or 99, then I'm buying it. And so that would be a good guide. But
it would be, and grown-ups would probably do that. Yep. The problem is, of course, there are a lot of young people who would ignore such warnings and simply say, it's new, all my friends have it.
Yep.
And that, I think, would probably drive the marketplace. So while I think that your idea is a wonderful idea, and I'd like to see it work, but I'm afraid that not enough of us would apply maturity to this and say, hold on a minute, is this worth it? Because the market would be dictated by the young vacuum heads.
Well,
and I don't mean to disparage all young people, but many of them are vacuum heads when it comes to this very topic. It's new. I got to have it.
Well, it was really just sort of a toss away. I really believe the only...
I think it's a good idea. I don't have a better idea, but I'm just afraid that it wouldn't be enough.
Well, I think you did have a better idea, and I want to second that. And that you... Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm sure that many people thought it sounded very extreme when you said it, but basically... Cyber criminals are no different than any other type of criminals. Lax laws and lax enforcement are responsible for all types of crime. We enable it. We encourage it by just giving people a little, tap on the wrist or, on the knuckles, and we let them get away with it. But if there were extremely punitive laws which were rigidly enforced, we could deter the great majority of crime, not just cyber crime, but all crime. Mm-hmm. And, of course, cyber crime is different in that I can commit a crime against you and your house being sitting over in yeah. Russia or Pakistan, and most other crimes, you actually have to be there to commit the crime.
Yeah.
So, like you said, we have drones, we have means, we have intelligence, and if the alternative is we've got to return to 1940 technology, I think that this is a time maybe to get our attention and get some men back in enforcement in this government and in the country, and have a significant effective deterrent to criminal activity. What should the onus be on every citizen to protect themselves? When I grew up, I didn't have to shred every piece of mail before I could put it in my trash. You have all these new rules, and every year we have more rules piled on top of rules of all these, you could have identity theft, and so you got to have this and that. Why? Let's deter the criminal.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you, Bob, and I thank you for your call. I would note, as we go to the break here, and we'll be back with more calls, I would note that I did suggest a pretty draconian measure, but I was suggesting it in regard to people who could destroy our entire civilization. I'm not suggesting that we seek out and execute jaywalkers, for example, but if you're talking about people who have the capability and the desire to bring down, let's say, our entire economy, and that's not hyperbole, that we're talking now about technology that some people might actually be in a position to do that, I suggested that those people be targeted with assassination, and I'm very serious about it, absolutely serious, but not casually. To be honest with you, Bob, if somebody steals my identity or yours, and I'm sorry for me and I'm sorry for you, but that I think the regular criminal justice system can handle that. If you're talking about somebody who can destroy our entire economy, where that you and your family and me and my family might starve to death, you find those people and you kill them. Back in just a moment. to have you with us on the Jimbo Hannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO. We're following up on our discussion with Mark Goodman, the author of Future Crimes, by just looking at technology in general and being pretty much forced in the direction of it. Some things are essential. Others are just passing fads that are of trivial importance. Steve is in Merritt, North Carolina, to join us. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Mr. Bannon. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I really admire you, and I listen to you all the time. On the cybercrime thing, and also on the government surveillance, supposedly, of our, I guess, internet apparatuses and whatnot, I got an email today from, like, the Tea Party, I guess, saying that if you own an Apple product, that you're under surveillance by the government, and which I have an Apple phone.
Well, I'm not enough of an expert to tell you exactly what's the truth behind that. I only know that there are devices out there that we buy that sometimes open the door to two-way communication. I don't know the extent to which what you have been told is a serious threat or just paranoia itself being propagated by technology. I honestly,
right.
I don't know, Steve.
My guess is I
wouldn't lose a lot of sleep over it, but go ahead.
You know, there's been so much talk about how much the government is, you know, invading your privacy on the internet. And you were talking about fraud earlier. Actually, 2 years ago, I was frauded on my IRS tax return by somebody that I have no clue was actually, they used the name Faye Ornott.
Well, did somebody take your tax refund, or what exactly happened to you?
Exactly. They actually fabricated a tax return showing that I was to get a return of $8,800. Mm-hmm. And, of course, when I got the return and saw what it said, I knew there was something wrong.
Yeah. Did you wind up explaining this to Internal Revenue?
Yes, sir. And they gave me a PIN number that I have to use every year from now on. And they give you a new number every year to validate that that is your return.
Yeah, well, that's something we all ought to have. A good point, I guess, on which to bring this to a conclusion for this evening, and that is real concrete solutions. I think it's unfortunate what happened to Steve, but that PIN number, give me one of those. Give me one of those. We'll be back with more on the Bohannon Show in just a moment. Good to have you with us on the Jim Bohannon Show. Thanks for joining us tonight. Thanks to our guest in the preceding hour, plus Mark Goodman, the author of Future Crimes. In the first hour this evening, we talked about Iran throwing a monkey wrench into this proposed nuclear deal. And we talked with Stephen Bucci of the Heritage Foundation, online at heritage.org, and Dr. Rachel Ehrenfeld of the American Center for Democracy, online at acdemocracy.org. Coming up on the Bohannon Show this coming evening, going to be talking with Bruce Henderson, who has written a book about a remarkable operation that took place in the closing months of World War II, a near impossible rescue of American prisoners from captivity in the Philippines. What took place has been hailed by many in the military as one of the best examples of a rescue ever. It's described in the book Rescue at Los Baños. And I'm looking forward to that as we are approaching Memorial Day and a time to remember heroes of that nature. If you go to JimboTalk.net, you can click on our poll. We asked you last week about how much sleep you get at night, and not a great deal. The plurality, 30% each, you said you got between 5 and 6 hours a night, or between 6 and 7 hours. Only 9% of you got more than 8 hours, but hey. The realities of life. This week's question has to do with that Iranian nuclear deal. What should be the next step in this? The framework as it stands should be accepted and negotiations continue to get a full agreement, or the framework as it stands should have to be approved by Congress before negotiations continue, or the framework should be changed to constrain Iran further before negotiations continue, or we should be bombing known Iranian nuclear facilities right now and not negotiating. Just go to JimboTalk.net. You can click on our poll. We'll tell you Monday what it is that you had to say. If you have a poll question, by the way, you can send it to producer@JimboTalk.net, and if we use yours, we'll give you credit on air. Incidentally, you can follow our producer, Paul Hill, on Twitter to get our guest list each week, each day, I should say. And that's @RadioPHH. All right. Masters Golf Tournament is underway, and coverage continues Friday, Saturday, and Sunday on WestwoodOneSports.com starting at 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Also at JimboTalk.net, Jimbo near you, and we will be near you in a couple of ways in the not-too-distant future. July 25th will be in Quincy, Illinois. And thanks to Mike Moyers, general manager of WTAD Radio AM 930, we'll be there to observe WTAD's 90th anniversary and Quincy's 175th anniversary. And I will be speaking in Quincy. Full details coming up in the not-too-distant future. First week in September, I'll be visiting our good friends at WCLO in Janesville, Wisconsin. Looking forward to getting back up there and having a chance to chat with some good folks there. Hereabouts, our producers, Paul Hill and Joe Ardinger. Our engineer is Bill Pimble. And yours truly right here, back with another Bohannon Show on this coming evening, which I think should be interesting and exciting. So I hope you'll join us at that time, if you would. Till then, I'm Jim Bohannon, and this is Westwood One.